Dr. Timothy Ryback is the co-founder of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague. Some of his previous books include the highly acclaimed Hitler's Private Library, the books that shaped his life, The Last Survivor, Legacies of Dachau, and Hitler's First Victims, The Quest for Justice. His latest book, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power, just came out and has already been showered with praise in all the biggest newspapers and outlets out there. Dr. Ryback, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If I may, I wanted us to begin this, kind of darkly astonishing story by setting the stage a little bit. It's really easy to just view these events through the lens of the great man of history theory, but I always find this approach kind of lacking and also not that exciting, to be honest. So I wanted us to talk about the Weimar Republic first. Usually, when we're presented with Germany in this period, so between the two world wars, it's in the form of a lot of tropes and cliches. Political instability, endless hedonism, particularly in Berlin, of course, cabaret culture, drugs on every corner, and lots of deadly street fights. What's wrong, if anything, with this picture?
Wait, first of all of those tropes that you described about the Weimar Republic are legitimate, are real.
They really did exist.
Yes. However, the Weimar Republic was around for 13 years, and different tropes apply to different moments in the Weimar history. So it wasn't as if it was 13 endless years of chaos, street violence, political instability and economic collapse. And in fact, the time period that we're talking about here, which is basically from July 1932 until January 1933, was actually, we saw the Weimar Republic gradually on the mend and overcoming some of these issues. I mean, the hyperinflation that we think of with people with wheelbarrows full of money, we're talking 1923. We're talking a decade earlier. The street violence, absolutely at that point. And also, I think that the political chaos, but it was a more mixed bag. And what I used to, I taught a course many years ago at Harvard University on Weimar Nazi culture. And I used to like to quote a Hans Frank, who was, I think, as you know, he was Hitler's private attorney, the Nazi party attorney, but went on to become the governor general of Nazi-occupied Poland. And right before he was hanged at Nuremberg for his complicity in crimes against humanity, Frank said something really insightful about democratic processes. He said, Hitler was only possible at that moment in time. He said, had we tried it a decade earlier, the German people would have gone back to the Kaiser and the stability that was there. Had we tried this a decade later, meaning in the 1940s or 1950s, you would have had an entire generation of Germans imbued with democratic values. But he said, we came at this perfect moment where, this perfectly horrific moment, where the German people were too far from the old system to retreat back, and too not far enough into the future to escape into democracy. So I think what, this 1932, up to the second half of 1932 was a complex and nuanced time. The German government realized that they had to respond to a lot of the issues out there. And one of Hitler's big talking points was the Treaty of Versailles, the stab in the back, and in particular, the war guilt clause and the imposition of the of reparation payments. There was the limitations of the German military restricting the army to 100,000, and these were all important talking points, not only for Hitler, but also for all the, you know, far right, you know, politicians who were against Weimar. But in fact, some of these conditions were being renegotiated in Geneva at that point. And had the Weimar Republic had an extra 6 months, I should also mention the economy was also recovering. You know, unemployment was still high, but everything was gradually on the mend. Had Hitler sort of been held from power for another 6 to 8 months, we'll talk about this later, but the conflicts even within his own party, this notion of the seizure of power, the reality of the seizure of power simply never would have taken place.
That's already super interesting that the Weimar Republic was on the up and the conditions were improving for most people. And yet the Nazis managed to drive a wedge between this and the public perception. And we're going to talk about this more, but I wanted to, just because I used to live in Berlin for a very long time, I have to ask you about the decadence in Berlin during the Weimar era. Was that a real thing, or is it just something cool that you put in a TV show or a movie because it conjures up this image that we all recognize instantly?
We were neighbors then, because I've lived in Berlin too. I still have an apartment there. And
Which area?
In Prenzlauer Berg.
Nice. The more bougie area, at least now it is.
It's gotten more bougie, but I have to say there are parts of Berlin that are still pretty hedonistic.
That's why I asked. Yeah, and I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely. Frankly, I think that the film Cabaret with Liza Minnelli, I actually think captures what Berlin was like at that moment perfectly. And there was an amazing cabaret scene. The drug scene was there. It was also very international. I mean, you'd had the Russian Revolution, so you had a lot of people fleeing into Germany, and they tended to come to Berlin. So Berlin itself was a melting pot of, you know, people from all over Europe, frankly, from all over the world. And there was, at the same time, it was called Red Berlin, and it was primarily social democrat and very strongly communist. I think it is still Red Berlin to a certain degree. I mean, they tend to vote, you know, much more left than right. But there was, and the Nazis were making inroads or working to make inroads there. So there really was a lot of street fighting, a lot of street violence there. So I think this chaos that one experiences, hears about, it absolutely existed. Now, what's funny is the biggest venue there for political rallies was called the Sportpalast, which was basically a big ice skating rink, but it could hold, you know, however many tens of thousands of people. And that's when we see these massive rallies there. And what they tend to show is Hitler standing in the Sportpalast in front of, you know, a massive number of people wearing swastika armbands and, you know, ranting and, you know, raving. What you don't realize is that was on one night. When you look at the actual scheduling of events at the Sportpalast, the night before, the communists were holding a rally there. And the Social Democrats were. I mean, it was just the place where you went to get a lot of people together. So it was, it was a very, there was a lot of tension, a lot of conflict. There was a massive transit strike right before the November election. And this is amazing, where the National Socialists and the Communists joined together to call a strike. So here you have cooperation between Nazis and communists who are killing themselves the day before and killing themselves the day after, but actually both endorsing a massive transit strike simply as a way of trying to shake the system to destabilize it. And I think the important thing is, the center was embattled at that time, but you had people on the far right and the far left both trying to bring the political system down through political chaos, and when necessary and very frequently through street violence.
Okay, so for this book, you read a lot of newspapers that were in circulation at the time. How did the Germans themselves view this era and the society they were living in?
Well, this is where I think if there's any added value to take over the book, this story has been told innumerable times by very eminent, very generations of eminent historians. But what one tends to do is to explain, which is the job of a historian, explain how we got from where we were to where we are. And in order to do that, you have to take those facts that make sense, that help explain the course of events. What that in turn does is necessarily weed out a lot of the extraneous noise that didn't contribute to where we ended up. What that also does then is to imbue events or individuals with kind of a sense of historical inevitability. I decided to forget everything that I knew about the era and simply started reading the daily press on a day-by-day basis, reading diary entries, meeting protocols, occasionally memoirs, but really tried to keep it in the moment without any foresight. And suddenly you see events that have disappeared from the narrative of Hitler's rise to power, suddenly playing an incredibly important role. I don't want to jump ahead, but I'm in the United States at the moment, and there's an election coming up in just over a week. No one can tell me, no one can say who's going to win this election at this point. I promise you, a week after the election, every pundit in America and probably around the world is going to explain exactly why this outcome was inevitable and highlight those events that led to this final outcome. But we, at this point, nobody knows. And so, you know, this book Takeover is really more about political contingency rather than historical inevitability. And even until as I was writing it personally, I knew the final outcome, but I was astonished at how many different routes history could have taken. And literally up to the last minute before Hitler was appointed chancellor, there was as good a chance of it not happening as there. In fact, he was lucky that it happened at that point, because if it hadn't happened at that moment, the history of the Weimar Republic and the 20th century would have been completely different.
So you're saying that reading the newspapers of the time, nobody saw it coming. The brightest pundits and political analysts of the time kind of didn't have a clue.
My favorite quote of the era was a very incisive political commentator who said, Adolf Hitler is a man with a great future behind him. And he was considered by late 32, yeah, he was really considered washed up. The part, and once again, we forget all of this, but July 32 Reichstag elections, the legislative elections, the Nazis got 37% of the vote, which was really their high water mark in a free and open election. Hitler was aiming for 51%. And so he held a second, they called a second round of elections, forced a second round of elections in November of 1932. Hitler expecting to get 51% absolute majority so he can just take control. Instead, they lose 2 million votes and they're down to 33%. Suddenly, there are divisions within the Nazi party. They've exhausted, and there was a series, there were a series of five election cycles there. The Nazi Party was bankrupt financially. One estimate put them at 90 million Reichsmarks in debt, which was the equivalent of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars today. So they were massively in debt. They were hemorrhaging members. First of all, they hemorrhaged voters. They lost 2 million voters. And on top of that, they started losing party membership. And there was a big split within. There were basically two factions in the party. There were the hardliners, people we know, Hermann Göring, Joseph Goebbels, who wanted sort of all or nothing. There was another wing led by a man named Gregor Strasser that wanted to enter into a coalition government compromise and sort of have the National Socialists get a foothold in government and then work to expand it. There was a split there. So, you know, as I say, by January 1933, you know, the party was bankrupt ideologically, financially, and, you know, in terms of membership was on the decline.
We're going to come back to this moment, but I wanted to ask you this before. When the Nazis appear on the scene, what are some of the cracks in the public perception, maybe of the Weimar Republic, that they begin exploiting? You touched on some already with the Treaty of Versailles, for example. Was it more of the kind of unchecked hedonism, the Treaty of Versailles, or was it the, like you already said, also the famous anti-Semitic conspiracy theory of a stab in the back, which posited that Germany didn't actually lose the First World War, but was betrayed by the inside, from the inside, by the Jews and the socialists? Was that the main kind of PR thrust of it all?
Yeah, because, you know, the hedonism was almost, I don't say exclusively, but primarily in your city of Berlin. I mean, it was really, that was the epicenter. You know, the German countryside, I mean, these are rural farmers. There's not a lot.
There was no cocaine in Bavaria. Is that what you're saying?
There's not a lot of cocaine in Bavaria. A lot of Lederhosen, you know, and a lot of beer.
Yeah.
Not much. Okay. But I think really the big talking point was the Treaty of Versailles, and it was sort of the whipping boy for everything. It was used to, it was the economic despair people were feeling, the humiliation of this war guilt clause and the imposition that, you know, the German military, and you have these great military traditions in Germany, going back to Frederick the Great, that the army was restricted to 100,000 soldiers. So these were Hitler's talking points. You know, what we forget is that in Geneva, there were discussions for undoing, and these were a burden on the German society. There's no question about it. And a lot of them were unfair. But these were Hitler's key talking points. But they, in Geneva, through traditional diplomacy, the Allies recognized the problem there, and they were gradually undoing these. The interesting thing about the anti-Semitism, it was clearly key and core to the Nazi identity and political agenda. What I find really interesting, and I've read hundreds, thousands of pages of Hitler speeches, basically, and the guy was holding sometimes five speeches a day. This was from, you know, mid-July until January of 33. And the references to Jews is actually very limited. I mean, it's reference in points, but the key talking points were, you know, to quote Bill Clinton, you know, it's the economy, stupid. You know, it's the economy, it's the economy, it's the economy. And he's going into these, you know, into these small communities, and he's talking to them about the economic despair and how the government has abandoned them. And it was, I mean, it was very similar to the talking points of the communists. I mean, everyone knew the economy was a problem. And I think that's where, you know, Hitler was, had increased. And keep in mind, after 1929, after the great crash of 1929 and the elections, the Nazis increase their share of the vote tenfold. I mean, they went from a marginal party to the second large, being the second largest party after the Social Democrats. And then in this July 1932 election, they claimed 37% of the vote, which made them the largest political party. And it was primarily on, you know, people were just despairing over their economics, primarily their economic situation, but also, you know, the Nazis wove, you know, a lot of other issues into there, you know, the war guilt humiliation, you know, Jewish conspiracies and all of that. But for the average German, I think, the key issue was the economy. And as Hitler would say, sort of this, you know, this old boys establishment network. I mean, you had in Berlin, you know, the basically a lot of aristocrats, running the government. The cabinet was, you know, the von Papen cabinet, and there was the von Schleicher cabinet. You know, the president was von Hindenburg. And in one speech, you know, Hitler was criticizing this, you know, this old boys network. You know, keep in mind, he is he's the Bohemian corporal. Okay. So he's, you know, threefold outsider. But, you know, one of his rallies, he said, you know, if aristocrats were made to rule Germany, we would have all been born with monocles. And it's, he was, you know, looking at certain degree, the elitism that was existing and that was a problem there. The key talking point really was with people's pocketbooks and just being able to make a living.
Do you think Weimar Republic did have some sort of inherent principal weakness? Because it always seems so fragile in hindsight. But again, we're talking in hindsight. Or does it, like you said, all basically harken back to the Wall Street crash of 29 and the terrible economic situation that befell most Germans afterwards?
It was a republic that had its flaws, but tell me any democratic system that if you look closely enough, you can't find one or the other flaw in the system. I think it was fundamentally a solid constitution. I think it guaranteed all of the basic rights that you need for a functioning democracy, which was freedom of speech, free press, due process of law, public referendum, which means if you didn't like someone, you would vote it. And the interesting thing that I find about, you know, Hitler and actually a lot of the right-wing forces there, they actually understood democracy as well as anyone and possibly even better. And Hitler had to appear in court at one point as a witness to a larger process, but this was, you know, keep in mind, back in 1923, he held the beer hall putsch.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it failed. He ended up in prison. And afterwards, he was released and he was allowed to enter political system on the promise that he would not, you know, promote any kind of violence against or the public overthrow, the violent overthrow of government. But here he is in court once, and he basically says, I am intent on destroying democracy. I hate democracy. I'm intent on destroying democracy through democratic process, which is a pretty amazing thing to say in court. The judge's response is even more amazing, which is, so by constitutional means only? And Hitler's answer was, jawohl. And he did very systematically. They knew what the touch points were, the weak points in the democratic system, and they worked very effectively to undermine it. When they entered the Reichstag, you know, the legislative branch, there were 12 guys in a 600-seat body, okay? But even at that time, Joseph Goebbels was one of the young delegates. He was a late 20-something, Nazi. He was not yet the minister of propaganda that we know him to be. This was just, you know, this young guy who had been elected as a National Socialist and came in as one of the first delegates to the Reichstag. And he says, we do not enter as friends. We do not enter as neutrals. We come here as your mortal enemies. And he said, you know, the big joke on democracy is that they give the tools of their own destruction to their enemies. And the Nazis really, when you look at how they use the system, when Hitler, what happened was Hitler, after this, the high water mark, this July 1932 election, which even in the Nazi histories, that these are the Nazi histories that were being written at that time, this was considered a crucial moment in their history because suddenly they had gone, and this is, you even hear it in Hitler's speeches when he's talking, or you see it. They themselves were astonished at what they had achieved.
The 37%, right?
Yeah, the 37%.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a decade earlier, you had seven guys sitting around a table trying to create a political movement. Now, the Bolsheviks had the backing from Moscow. They had, you know, they had weapons, they had financing, they had, you know, an infrastructure that was supporting them. The Social Democrats had been around since the 1890s as a political party. You had the conservative, you know, the Christian parties that had been part of the political system. And here you had seven guys entering the system and within a matter of 12 years had become the largest political party and system. Now, this is the point I was getting at with this, with democracy, is that, you know, Hitler's point was, and his logic, he had this meeting with Hindenburg in August of 32. And generally what it is, the largest political party, who had the largest percentage in the Reichstag, got to have their leader as the chancellor, who would then build a coalition of other parties. Hindenburg, who is the president, who had the right to appoint and dismiss chancellors at will, despised Hitler. He's the one who called him the Bohemian Corporal. He famously said, if I were to appoint Hitler to any position, it would be as postmaster general, so he could lick me from behind on my stamps. But so he wanted, and you know, he told Hitler to his face, for the sake of God, my conscience, and the country, I would never appoint you as chancellor. So this is August 32. Hitler's argument to the contrary was, he says, we're functioning in a democracy. He said, I have 37% of 51%, you know, a simple majority. So I have 37% is 75% of 51%, which gives me the majority of the simple majority, and therefore I should have complete control. You know, Hindenburg basically said, you know, go home and do some more math. He said, this isn't the way it's going to function. But what Hitler did very effectively was, and this is where he understood it, he used that 37% to either crush, co-opt, or browbeat everyone else in the right-wing opposition, because all of these other parties are, you know, having, you know, 5% or 8%. I mean, one of the big problems with the Weimar Republic is that they had literally dozens of political parties, which was very democratic. It was very representative, but it also led to a fracturing. And what, when Hitler wasn't given power, he said, okay, we're going to go into opposition and we can paralyze the legislative, with our 37%, we can paralyze the legislative process. And that's basically what they did. They could not get any laws passed because with that percentage, they simply blocked any legislation. And part of the problem was that the communists and the social democrats hated each other as much as they hated the Nazis. So there was this unwillingness to enter into coalitions that would allow for a functioning government with a simple majority of the Reichstag.
Yeah, if we take a step back yet again, just because I'm fascinated by this aspect, the economic crisis, which was global after the crash of 29, it wasn't a local German thing, and yet Nazism didn't spring up in Poland or France, for example, even though these countries also had a long history of anti-Semitism, for example. What made Germany so susceptible to this threat?
I know you don't like the great man theory, but I think Hitler was really a unique political figure.
Fair.
I don't want to say singular, but this man had just, there was some kind of charisma about him, but also this ability, and this is the odd thing, he blinded himself to the most obvious defeats. He ran against Hindenburg in the 1932 presidential election. He lost by 6 million votes. He claimed voter fraud, and he actually went to court and tried to have the election overturned. They threw him out on his ear. But what he did was, and he had actually gotten 37% personally in that election. He claimed victory and went on to this next election, which was the Reichstag election. And he simply, even when they lost those 2 million votes in the November elections, they lost, you know, down to 33% from 37%. He declared victory anyway. And what he said was, now, and people said, well, we're hemorrhaging membership. You know, we've lost. He said, but what we have are the core people who matter. He says, we've gotten rid of the weak people, those who are not, you know, have 100% loyalty. And he, you know, every situation he was in, he simply blinded himself to anything that looked like defeat and drove forward. Now, In some cases, people end up driving off the cliff or into a brick wall. But Hitler had a series of events and the circumstances that allowed him to keep moving forward. The great Hitler biographer Ian Kershaw did this massive two-volume thing, and he tried. You know, at the end of this, he said, "You know, the only explanation you really have for Hitler is that this man had the luck of the devil. And he just, circumstances again and again and again just fell in his favor." You know, it goes back to the Hans Frank thing. Hitler not come to power in January of 33, what would have happened, the party was massively in debt, okay? They would have been, the people had stepped up to the plate to give him money. Suddenly he got some people, yeah, there were some bankers who wanted nothing to do with him. Suddenly in January, they said, look, we'll put our money with Hitler. Had he not been appointed chancellor, they would have backed away. the party membership would have been dismayed. He would have begun to lose people. It would have remained a political force, but I suspect they would have probably gone down to, ended up at 24, 26%, had been a political force, but would not have been in a position to take over. So it was really that critical moment in January when, you know, he was appointed that allowed it to happen. But and so why in Germany? I mean, I think Hitler in particular, given the fact that he wasn't even German famously, you know, he was from Austria, and only in February of 1932 did he get German citizenship. He was basically a stateless person. And when he railed against the immigrants, he himself was, you know, was a foreigner in Germany. But I think, you know, the size of the economy, the fact that it was relied on an industrial base, there was a, you know, large force of workers who were either going to go far left or far right. And even when you look at voting patterns, you know, the workers, you know, people who were voting communist didn't go to the center. They went from the far left to the far right in these elections. So it was basically, and it goes back to the economy, it was basically, you know, the average person just trying to get by.
I've heard you say something extremely interesting. You said that Hitler was actually banned from the Twitter of the day, the X of the day, which back then was radio. On the other hand, historians like to say that the Nazis were super savvy when it came to using mass media. Like you said, there were a bunch of young guys, right? So how can we square these two seemingly contradictory statements?
He was banned from radio, which was the Twitter of the day, partially because of his extremist rhetoric. He just couldn't get on. Whereas other, you know, the political leadership could get on. And as Hitler himself observed, you know, in 10 minutes could reach tens of millions of people. Hitler himself was restricted to rallies. He was also tended to be banned. He wasn't covered in the mainstream press. So his ability to reach beyond his own echo chamber was very limited. He did two things that were fairly innovative in 1932. One was another technology had come along were phonograph records. And what Hitler did was to record speeches on phonograph records and then distribute those by the tens of thousands. And this was sort of
For free, or did people have to buy them?
They had to buy them, but they were available at kiosks.
So you bought like a vinyl record from Hitler.
With Hitler's speech on it.
Okay.
What's really interesting about it is I have listened to some of these. They're pretty hard to find, but this is not ranting and raving. This is Hitler trying to talk, and there's no talk of anti-Semitism. I mean, it's Hitler talking about the economy, about stabilizing the country, about the return of, you know, the dignity of the German people, and not ranting and raving, but actually in a very moderated tone, just letting you know. The other thing that he did, so one was using phonograph records. The other was he realized the only way he could get around in Germany was to a rally was by train or by car. Okay. And at most he could do one or two rallies a day. He leased a passenger plane from Lufthansa and realized that he could do up to five rallies a day. So this man, and this is the first time in German political history that an aircraft was used for political campaigning. It was sensational in the day. So people wanted to show up to see, you know, Hitler arriving in planes, you know, arriving in a plane and then coming to a village or a town and talking. You know, there are images of him in his plane, you know, flying over Berlin and flying over Nuremberg and all the big cities. But he was also landing in farmers' fields in little villages, walking across the field, going into a tent and giving a talk to, you know, a talk about with a speech to villagers, you know, for, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, tramping back to the plane and then flying to another location. And, you know, Hitler, this is where he really reached the heartland of Germany. He was in places that most German politicians had never even heard of. So it really, and it was, you know, when you look at the hundreds of places that he visited, you know, large and small, it was really a remarkable move on his part. And I do think helped, you know, establish sort of him in parts of the country that he was completely unknown. And also it was great advertising, but incredibly innovative for, you know, trying to overcome, you know, some of these other obstacles that he faced.
Okay, one thing I never managed to get through my head was Hitler's so-called mass appeal. Historians always talk about his magnetic charisma, about people literally fainting in his presence, his supposedly masterful oratory skills. But all I see is some extremely weird, awkward little kind of penguin of a guy with a particular mustache. And also, anyone can go on YouTube and check out one of his speeches today and just see Hitler sweating profusely at the podium, making these grand, silly chaplain-like gestures, screaming like he's having a fit. He's not hard to parody, which is probably why Chaplin did it. I just do not get it. What am I missing here?
One of the things is these speeches that we see that are recorded are Hitler after he's come to power. These are at these mass rallies that are organized and orchestrated. You know, the famous, most of these clips are from the Nuremberg rallies or from the Sportpalast, and you're taking him at his most fanatic moments. In some ways, it's Hitler unleashed, it's Hitler unchained. Once again, you need to back up. And this is where this issue of historic hindsight. We look and we go, oh, how is this possible? And yeah, I'm not saying he was not a fanatic orator, but there was some kind of charisma that he had in these smaller settings, even where you heard it from Albert Speer, who had been a student of architecture. He went as a student to a Hitler rally, a young man, and was just transfixed and won over. The same with Leni Riefenstahl, the
film director.
She was film director. At the time, she'd been a famous actress, and Hitler had wanted to meet her just because she was a pretty young thing. He then invited her to one of his rallies, and it was the same thing. She was mesmerized and transfixed. So there was something about it. The most interesting visit, and once again, this goes back to the early Hitler, there was a psychologist named Hans Prinzhorn, and he wrote, his legacy is that he wrote the first book about the relationship between artistic expression and insanity. And it's it was a landmark book at the time. But Prinzhorn, he was a critic, he was an analyst, and he went to a Hitler rally, and ended up writing a fascinating series of articles analyzing Hitler and exactly what you said. And what was clear to him was Hitler's mastery of not so much the language, but he said the rhythm and intonation. And he said Hitler would bring something up to a peak, like a almost a phonetic peak, and then stop, and things and drop like this. And he said you could feel the pressure in the room just go down. And he said it was more an emotional response to this, and his ability to as much an emotional experience as it was an intellectual experience. And he said, you know, a lot of what Hitler said was complete nonsense, but this mesmerizing quality, this ability to convey emotion and to connect with the audience. And he said he really knew how to read an audience. So, and what we're talking about is not a mass stadium with, you know, 10 or 20,000 people in there at the Nuremberg rally grounds, you know, we're talking about a beer hall with a couple of hundred people in it. A crowded setting, you know, people are packed in there, you know, Hitler on stage, and his ability to read a crowd and manipulate it. And Prinz Horn's, and this is the most, I found the most interesting observation, Hitler was one of these Teflon politicians, you know, just, he could make the most absurd statements, he could contradict himself, it just did not touch him. And what Prinz Horn said was, you know, the problem with Hitler's opponents is that they think that they are, when they catch Hitler on a contradiction or an inconsistency, and they go after it, they're going after the intellectual part of it. He said, what they don't understand is that Hitler's connection to his constituency is at an emotional level. And that's why he just, they will never bring him down. I mean, it was an early analysis, but I think it was really, Prinz Horn stood back. And as you said, it wasn't the penguin-like character or this, Hitler caricature of himself practically. This was actually a man who in a smaller setting knew how to read an audience. The other thing that you also lack that you don't see in the earlier ones is how much humor there was. Hitler, believe it or not, based on these transcripts of the speeches, was a very funny man.
Really?
Can
you tell us a joke that he maybe told, or how funny, in what way? I mean, I read a lot about Stalin, and he had a particular brand of like dark humor, and it's recorded often in his biographies. But Hitler, I never heard about that about him.
Well, what you'll see when you read the transcripts of his speeches, you'll see the word Heiterkeit, in various ways, which means sort of laughter, and heftige Heiterkeit. And then you'll see waves of laughter, and it comes up again and again. And what he tended to do was to make fun of his political opponents for the most part. You know, I mentioned the one about, if Germany was meant to be run by aristocrats, with monocle. There was one of his main political opponents on the right wing was a man named Alfred Hugenberg. And, he said, Hugenberg is, nothing more than this dog that's brought out for tricks on stage to run around and then go back. And, Hugenberg was kind of this guy with these big handlebar mustache. He was this portly guy. He was actually a pretty comical looking figure, so he wasn't difficult to parody. But, Hitler would go after his political opponents like this. And it was sort of mean spirited type of humor. But as I say, you forget that, or not forget, we never even knew that a Hitler rally in the early days was actually a pretty funny thing. It was Hitler made a reference to Ford, because Ford was a vicious, Henry Ford, the industrialist, was a vicious anti-Semite. And Hitler actually really liked, embraced, Ford's anti-Semitism. Ford published two volumes of a book called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. There was a translation of that, and Hitler used to have copies of it outside of his office, translation in German that he used to give to people. But it was sort of a phrase like, Ford's politics certainly runs better than his cars do. But sort of, little things, but constant little jabs. Yeah, there's more jabs, but
could he take a joke about himself, or was that a step too far?
I suspect not.
Okay,
I suspect not.
Makes sense.
I think Hitler took himself too seriously. And I think those around him took him too seriously. I mean, that's a really interesting question, but I can't think of anyone who survived to. There were people who made comments about him that were pretty funny, but they didn't live to laugh.
Okay, you already told us what his biographer, Ian Kershaw, said about Hitler and his luck of the devil. But what do you think? Was this guy actually a political mastermind? Did he see the path to power clearly all along and was playing some sort of 4D chess? Or was it just maybe a combination of some sort of low cunning that he did have and most of all luck?
I think his grand strategy was with Weimar was, as he said, from the very beginning, to destroy democracy through democratic process. I don't think he had that was the grand strategy, but he was a political opportunist. And when the right opportunity came along, he was able to seize it or manipulate any moment or individual to his advantage. With that said, this luck of the devil played a really big role because there were so many moments when Hitler could have or should have failed or fallen, and things just fell to his advantage. To a certain degree, this Teflon quality that Hans Prinzhorn had described, because, you know, Hitler could do things that could bring down any other politician, but somehow was able to get away with it. Can I back up for 1 second?
Please.
You mentioned the humor. As I mentioned, people making fun of him. I mean, you know, the Hindenburg quote, first of all, of, you know, this Bohemian corporal, but also the
stamps,
the postage stamp story. But the cartoons making fun of Hitler are just endless. And a lot of them in the newspapers are very funny. We are talking about how Hitler appeared to be at the end. This is a cartoon from mid-January 1933, just before Hitler is 2 weeks before he's made chancellor. It shows Hitler standing in a graveyard, in a cemetery, and, you know, sort of like this, all the headstones, no, holding his own head, I think, anyway, but all the headstones are broken swastika crosses, and the title underneath it is The New Hamlet. And, you know, it was, this guy was just washed up, but they were finding the other cartoon that I love. It's from Hitler, in one occasion, was literally caught with his pants down, and it was called Hitler's Underwear Moment. And there are these wonderful cartoons of Hitler out there like this. So I should say, he was, within his inner circle, no one was making fun of him, but there was a tremendous amount of ridicule. And this was actually in the fall of 32. And I've heard other politicians in the contemporary situation say the same thing. You know, Hitler said, "For the last 12 years, people have been laughing at me. Nobody's laughing anymore." Ooh. Yeah. And this is when he went on to add, he said, "Heads will roll." So the man's, I talked earlier about Hitler's blindness to defeat, his blindness, or whatever it is, his inability to be humiliated, or his capacity to hold off humiliation. This man was subjected to so much ridicule, to so much humiliation, that you'd say for any normal human being, how could you stand it? But he was just blinded to this and kept going. And, you know, and as I say, it is, your reaction was my reaction when I saw this in one of his speeches. You've laughed at me for the last 12 years. No one's laughing anymore. So
you actually managed to interview Hitler's last private secretary, Traudl Junge, whose memories were the basis for the famous film Der Untergang, or The Downfall, which was depicting his last days in the bunker in Berlin and has been memed to oblivion on the internet. Anyway, has anything she told you about Hitler surprised you, or perhaps has stayed in your mind?
Well, you know, there's this term about, you know, 6 degrees of separation. Well, with Traudl Junge, I was one handshake of separation. Yeah, I did. Right before, Traudl Junge was Hitler's private secretary. There were, Hitler had lunch right before he committed suicide in April of 45. And there were four people at the lunch table. Adolf Hitler, Eva Braun, Traudl Junge, and another secretary. I connected with her because when I was working on my book on Hitler's private library, I was coming across repeated marginalia a large collection of books on the spiritual, on the occult, on various religious, various religions, different forms of higher powers that shape the world. And I was just curious about this because a lot of them had marginalia. And so I sought out Traudl Junge and I, said to her, and was able to spend a half a day talking to her about, her experience and her time with him. But the real question was, I first of all showed her photocopies of the marginalia and also these books. And she did confirm, she said, he read a book a night, and she used to have breakfast with him every morning. So he said she would, what she remembered was him sort of holding an endless exegesis about his previous night's reading. But she said, yes, he was preoccupied by this notion of what he called Vorsehung, or providence, some higher power that was guiding him. And part of this came from the fact that, this is going back to Kirchhoff's Luck of the Devil. There were at least 25 assassination attempts on Hitler, that he survived. The most famous one being in, the general's plot. Yeah, the Stauffenberg plot, where the bomb goes off next to him. Traudl Junge remembers she was with him. She was in her room at that point. The bomb had gone off, and she remembers him knocking at her door and opening it, and his uniform was still smoldering. But he said, he then later claimed that, this was proof that, he was protected by higher powers. And she said something really interesting. And so I said to her, well, did he, was this just for public consumption, or did he believe it? And, she said he didn't necessarily believe on a bearded God sitting on a cloud, with a protective halo over him. But she said he did believe, she said, if anything, it would have been in some kind of, in the realm of physics and metaphysics, that somehow were guiding him to a larger destiny that he believed in. That was her opinion. But then she said something very important. She says, but how can anyone know what another person actually believes or doesn't? Which I, to my mind, you said if there's any takeaway from it, was really, it suggested the credibility. The woman understood the man that she had been serving. And once again, a bit like the Riefenstahl and a bit like the Speer had, been drawn into this, but found herself at the absolute epicenter of this as sort of just a young woman, but had been, processing it, over the decades. As they say, for me, it was an experience sort of one degree of separation from really one of the most important moments in in history.
It is a little bit, I mean, I don't know what which word to use, ironic or funny, that Hitler was spiritually closer to some New Age yoga mom than to a Protestant pastor.
Well, actually, yeah, and I'll tell you what, there's some very bizarre manuscripts. He has this 300-page manuscript that was given to him. And once again, this has marginalia in it, with all of this mapping about how all these different forces in the world sit together. And it really does read like sort of this New Age spiritualism, you know, rather than, you know, he was raised as a Roman Catholic, but certainly not sort of your traditional, I'd say, you know, God on the cloud with the beard and the thunderbolt.
I interviewed Norman Ohler. He wrote the popular book Blitzed, you know, about Hitler taking a bunch of drugs. Do you think there was something to it?
I think when you look at Hitler's actions and decision-making processes early on, I don't think they touched on the core of who he was. I think with or without drugs, Hitler was single-minded, was blinded. I mean, you know, the Leni Riefenstahl film, Triumph des Willens, you know, yeah, the triumph of the will.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Hitler, when you listen to his own astonishment in his speech of saying, we started out with seven people, and there's never been anything like this in German political history, and there really hadn't been. It's just an astonishing success story. And he went from one to the other. So I think drugs maybe played a marginal role, but I think with or without drugs, the Hitler that we saw straight through to the end was the same. And I think, you know, my conversations with Charles Jung about Hitler in those last bits was just a man who was incredibly depressed, was in despair, was enraged at, he felt that, you know, it was the failure of people around him that led to what happened. So the, you know, the medication was there and may have had some influence, but with or without, I think the course of action that we saw was pretty much, you know, the man that we have come to know. And with that said, I think the film Der Untergang, you know, Downfall, with Bruno Ganz playing Hitler, I think captured who he was in those final days, those final weeks, as perfectly as it's ever going to be captured.
Okay, if we go back to the events before Hitler's takeover, I was always fascinated by the accounts of the intellectuals of the day, in particular the disdain with which they viewed the Nazis. I don't remember who it was, maybe it was the writer Thomas Mann, maybe not, who said that Hitler coming to power was actually pretty amazing because he thought that Hitler, if he did come to power, the absurd caricature of a politician that he was, he would fail so spectacularly that the left would simply swoosh in and effortlessly pick up the pieces. Could you talk about this intellectual current of underestimating the Nazis and Hitler at the time a little bit?
You know, it's interesting. This goes back to Hitler's reading, is that he read a book a night for his entire adult life. I interviewed most of the people around Hitler's, the surviving people around Hitler's entourage. And you hear this again and again. I think what that reflects is this incredible intellectual insecurity on Hitler's part. He was just intellectually insecure, but also, you know, never completed what we'd call high school, and also lacked sort of the critical thinking that went into reading. So he could read a novel by the adventure writer
Karl May.
But he could also be trying to read excerpts from Schopenhauer, and would just pace.
A very eclectic mix.
Yeah, it's and his library reflects this. And what it is, Hitler once described reading as, he does this in Mein Kampf, actually. He says, you know, the problem with people when they read is that they try to learn as they're going, and you get so many ideas that you get confused. He said, for me, reading is like a mosaic. He said, I take a preconceived notion, and then I read to take those pieces that fill in the mosaic. He said, you know, otherwise you really just get too confused by all this. But it means you can have you can be reading Karl May and using that as military strategy while reading Clausewitz. So it is kind of this absurd, pathetic intellect. And it was, you know, there was a famous quote by Oswald Spengler, who wrote this, you know, iconic book, Decline of the West, who, you know, basically said that, you know, Hitler really was very similar to the Thomas Mann thing. You know, that's just, you know, an intellectual zero when it came to it. And as I say, Hitler did recognize this lack in him. And although I believe he had a photographic memory, when you listen to people talking about him, his recall, but what he lacked was sort of the critical thinking abilities to sort through all of this. This issue about, you know, whether it was Thomas Mann or someone else, you know, get Hitler into office and watch him crash and burn. People were placing bets on how long this guy was going to be in office. And you have to keep in mind, Hindenburg, as president, had the ability to appoint or dismiss chancellors at will. And in the previous 8 months, had done exactly that with three previous chancellors. There was nothing stopping him from doing that with Hitler. And even after he came to power in February of 33, you read the press, and this would be the left wing and the centrist press, and they're all betting on how long he's actually going to be, how much longer he's going to be in office. And there's one amazing a diary entry from January of 34, which is basically, how is this possible that this man is still in office? So it's, you know, and once again, this is not historical inevitability. And then you have to ask yourself, well, why didn't these contingencies play out differently? You know, why did we end up on this particular road?
Okay, so the highest number of votes that Hitler got in an election, like you said, was 37%. However, after this high watermark of Hitler's political career, the fortunes were turning for the Nazis, and they begin to bleed votes as well as funds quite rapidly. How is it possible then that despite this dramatic turn for the worse, which you outlined before, Hitler still comes out on top and in January 33 becomes the German chancellor?
Well, he's considered, he's basically, by January of 33, he really is considered washed up. I mean, you have this, you know, you have this Hamlet cartoon, you have this, my favorite one being, you know, Hitler is a man with a great future behind him. I mean, it's just, it's over for Nazis. Joseph Goebbels in his diaries is just writing about, you know, what a catastrophe everything is. Hitler is just blind to this. You know, he's still going through. And what happened was, there was concern, and this is what we tend to forget about. There was a real concern about a Bolshevik revolution, a violent revolution. And the fact is, there really was a threat of a possible Bolshevik revolution. And conservatives who originally had distanced themselves from Hitler said, let's put some money, you know, in this particular account and see what happens. He's the best alternative out there. The part of the problem was Hindenburg had run out of people that he liked, of possible candidates, because he wanted a conservative chancellor. And a man named Kurt von Schleicher had been the previous chancellor, thought he was in a stable position. He called himself the last horse in Hindenburg's stable. He really figured there was no alternative. Well, when Schleicher ran into problems and they had to look for another chancellor, Hindenburg was gradually convinced that Hitler was really the best man to solve that crisis at that moment. And Hindenburg said, agreed to this on the condition that he would never be left alone in a room with that man. Also, the von Papen, who was another one of these aristocrats and also former chancellor, said that once Hitler was in office, his rhetoric would cool. The operative phrase there was soup. You never eat soup as hot as it's cooked. So once he's there, and the other operative phrase is, Hitler only had three National Socialists on the cabinet. So they said, once he's in power, we'll get him into a corner so tight that he'll squeak. So I think what they did was they had this Bohemian corporal, they had this Austrian, they were all of these, Prussian, mostly Prussian aristocrats, wealthy industrialists, the men who had been controlling Germany for, the last decade, well, actually for, most of German history was controlled by the elites. And, they get this, this half-educated Austrian in there with the odd accent and, don't worry, we'll get it. We got it. But just as Hitler knew what the touch points were to bring down democracy or the democratic structures and processes, how to paralyze it, he knew the key touch points in coming to power, where he could push, where he could back off, and ultimately. He came in fairly modestly. He didn't come in ranting. And when you watch even the video footage, there's the actual newsreel footage of the cabinet assembling and, Hitler, coming in and taking his place, but no one not seeming terribly, exceptional. I'm in charge now. So it's a, it was a process where they felt like they had him, under wraps, and in some ways did have them under wraps. Unfortunately, he made a career of being underestimated. And once again, the luck of the devil, the biggest piece of luck he had was the burning of the Reichstag. And, that was, until that point, things were still, Hitler was having to play careful. These bets were on how long can this guy really stay in office? And then you have on Monday, February 27th, 33, the Reichstag goes up in flames. It's considered a national emergency. Emergency decrees are introduced. A lot of fake news out there about, there had been this seething notion of a Bolshevik revolution. Well, or attempted overthrow. The Bolsheviks were immediately blamed at the communists. To this day, we don't actually know.
I thought the Nazis did that themselves.
Well, this is the point. The people on the left said that, the socialists and communists said the Nazis did it. The Nazis said the communists did it. And the most astonishing thing is to this day, we do not know definitively how this happened, whether it was just this, crazy Dutchman, running around in the Reichstag, setting things ablaze. But the fact is, this is one of these luck of the devil moments, if it was orchestrated by the Nazis, and I'm not sure it was, but Hitler knew how to seize that particular moment. And of all the bits of luck that the man had, in his entire political career, that probably is the key moment.
What are some of the most obvious or glaring parallels between Hitler's takeover and our own times? And I'm not even going to mention any names, but when you were describing Hitler's rise to power, some images, some parallels offered themselves immediately, like Hitler being impervious to telling lies, not acknowledging that he lost an election, bullying of political opponents, and so forth. Could you break these down, these parallels, a little bit further?
Well, Donald Trump, I think that's where you're going. Donald Trump never said heads will roll. What he said was bring out the guillotine.
More like French Revolution style.
Did the same thing, yeah, when heads did roll. So the point is, but let me actually start with the biggest difference, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
The biggest difference between Adolf Hitler and Donald Trump were in the polling numbers. Donald Trump is polling numbers that Adolf Hitler never could have dreamed of having. Right around 50%, you know, whether it's 48% or 51%, depending on the poll that you're looking at. Hitler never did better than 37%. Well, actually, yeah, in a free and open election, Adolf Hitler never did better than 37%. He never had, among the German people, the current level of support that Donald Trump has among the American electorate. And that, to my mind, is, you know, there are, you know, lots of unsettling parallels, but to my mind, that is one of the most striking when you're looking at a comparison soon, because you really have to think about it, you know, that, you know, here we see Hitler as this, the German people en masse behind him, and yet never able to pull higher than 37%. And, you know, as I say, could never even have dreamed of the numbers that Trump has at this point. The similarities, there are a lot of facile ones. Hitler was telling, when he was telling his followers to show up at for the November 32 election, quote unquote from Donald Trump, which was, he says, be there. It's going to be wild. As you mentioned, the belittling of political opponents, this Teflon ability to deflect every kind of criticism, frankly, this resilience to being mocked and humiliated, you know, repeatedly, is same. But I think that the clearest similarity in my mind is this self-imposed blindness to anything that would resemble defeat. And, you know, including losing an election and going to court to have the election results overthrown. But this blindness to anything that doesn't fit sort of his particular vision of where things are. And, you know, it is, you know, Hitler was a man who remarkably was able to take events and shape them to his will. You know, this triumph of the, you know, this notion of this Nietzschean notion of the Superman, really, really did apply to Hitler. And, you know, there could have been a number of people along the way who maybe could have filled some kind of role, but didn't have the luck, and for one reason or another fell by the wayside, and Hitler just lucked there. Though I cannot think of a single German politician who came even close to Hitler in terms of what you'd call charisma. And it's a bit like, I think, when you look at the American political landscape, I don't see anyone out there that has this type of character and this nature. What I would say about this current situation is one of my favorite quotes from an old eminent historian is that the Weimar Republic died twice. It was murdered and it committed suicide. We know who the perpetrator of the murder was. That's very clear. But the fact was, for an act of state suicide is much more complicated, especially when it involves a constitutional republic with all the protections of, you know, freedom of speech, public referendum, due process. And you have, in some ways, I think that can apply to the United States. You know, Donald Trump has, you know, called himself said that he would be dictator on day one. And I'm not saying that American democracy will be dissembled, but I think it is, when you take Trump at his word, one should find some of this worrying. When you talk about vengeance on political opponents, when you look at this fomenting of hatred against, you know, different groups of people, whether they're immigrants or whatever. When you look at that accumulatively, one should be unsettled by that. And the fact that you have 51% of Americans, you know, hearing this and are willing to accept it, I think this old notion of dying twice does apply in this case. Well, do I think that America will collapse into a dictatorship? No, but I think the guardrails of our democratic system are being tested to the extreme. But also, this maybe you talked earlier when we began about, you know, the structures of, you know, what were there structural flaws in the Weimar Republic, in the Weimar Constitution. There may be fundamental flaws in what we call a democracy. You know, does it require people being willing to play by the rules? Hitler's avowed goal to destroy democracy through democratic process, which he did. The one piece here, maybe this to close this up, is that the one thing that did survive the entire Nazi period was the Weimar Constitution. Hitler, it was never revoked. The Weimar Constitution remained in place as the legal basis for the government all the way until the end of the war. And then only after the war did they come up with what was called the Grundgesetz, this founding law. But that then suspended the Weimar Republic, which means that everything that happened in Nazi Germany, there were various emergency decrees and special this enabling act and all of that, but the Constitution itself remained intact through that entire period. I do believe that the American Constitution will remain intact. But one can worry about how it's interpreted, how it's used, how it's misused, how it's abused.
Okay, very last question. If I may offer just an important distinction between Trump and Hitler, maybe that is that Trump just seems like an obscene con man, more of that kind of type, who believes in nothing really and will basically say anything he needs to propel himself forward, basically an opportunist. And not a very bright one at that. I doubt that Donald Trump reads books, much less one a day. Hitler, on the other hand, actually had a vision, an extremely terrifying one at that. But it was there because he detailed it in his book long before he came to power, or shortly before he came to power. Would you agree that there is this kind of crucial difference between the two?
Yeah, I think, yes. And I think that with Donald Trump, he's a businessman, and everything is transactional. And I think that's the word that he uses, that he is completely open about it. Hitler was a dark visionary, you might say, but what really did surprise me, even when the party was in its deepest crisis, this was in December of 32, when they'd lost their votes, when they were bankrupt, when they were hemorrhaging, you know, votes and members, you know, Hitler was not going to move from his particular vision for Germany. I guess both men have written books, and maybe it reflected, you know, I think Hitler, you know, wrote Mein Kampf, in which he kind of laid out everything that you needed to know about Hitler and what was to happen. It can be found in the pages of Mein Kampf. And I think, you know, if you're looking for the parallel or the bookend one to that, I think, you know, Trump's art of the deal is, you know, it is transactional, and
I heard he didn't even write that. I heard that he had a ghostwriter.
Yeah, well, he did, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, that's as well. Well, I mean, though there are those claims also about Adolf Hitler, because, you know, one of his aides was, well, the question was, you know, actually it was, you know, it was Hitler dictating it, but, you know, one, Rudolf Hess, you know, hammering this out on a typewriter, how much was edited or not, but yeah.
Very, very quickly, the very last question, I promise. Our era is maybe a bit different in that we are facing many existential global challenges today, like from growing wealth inequality, climate breakdown, AI, and so forth. As somebody studying one of the worst times in human history, do you think these sort of collective challenges are more likely to bring us all together or to produce another Hitler or many local Hitlers?
My main concern, when you look for parallels or similarities, is that it's no secret Trump's affection for Putin. And I think in a trans or other authoritarian leaders, my concern is that both of these men have very similar personality types, which is also Hitler's personality types, which you never admit defeat. When you're confronted, you double down. They can be these transactional relationships until it reaches a point of confrontation. And what I keep remembering is the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where there was a transactional relationship between Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler to invade Poland in 1939. I mean, we keep remembering, and we, you know, clearly it's the German invasion of Poland from the West into the East, but we forget that the Red Army came into Poland moved west, and that the two men divided up that country. Okay. But what happens 2 years later in spring of 1941, we end up with the greatest land battle in history as these two men confront each other and end up with, you know, the absolute cataclysm. And I guess my one concern would be that when you get these, and this is becoming an era of strong authoritarian leaders. We've seen that across, you know, the Germans call it Zeitgeist. You know, my one big concern is not only what the domestic implications might be of a second Trump presidency, but also in terms of global affairs. People will find they'll find common cause in dealing however they want to deal with a situation like Ukraine, and one can be very fearful of that outcome. But I think in the long, or but the Baltic states for that matter, or whatever, what the implications would be. But I think in the longer term, these two men are too similar in terms of the personality and reaction. And there, you could lead, it could, I could imagine an absolute worst case scenario. And as I say, to my mind, the Stalin-Hitler relationship keeps resonating strongly when it's comes down to these transactional relationships rather than what we used to call diplomacy.
Dr. Rybak, thank you so much for taking the time. Where can people find your book, Takeover? Find bookstores everywhere, I suppose, including online.
Yes, and online. And there's an ebook, there's the Kindle version and Amazon.
Thanks again. Absolute pleasure. And I hope we get to do this again in the future.
Wonderful talking. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. This podcast has no sponsors, no production team, and no editors. It's just little old me. And as such, I'm at the mercy of you lovely folks watching and listening. So please do subscribe on YouTube. Click that little bell thing. Follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Also, I don't want to sell you an ugly t-shirt that you don't really need. So if you can, and most of all, if you want, please support me on Patreon. And at this point, I have to express my eternal gratitude to my patrons on Patreon, aka the producers of this show. As always, without you, comrades, this podcast simply wouldn't exist. So massive, massive thank you to Ole, Marin Ferrara, Aljaš, Štrole, Aida, Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordon, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronika, and Taichi. You guys are the best.